It's time now for Super Psychologist, Dr. Mara Karpel, and your golden years.
Good evening and welcome to Dr. Mara Karpel and your golden years this evening and every Sunday evening at 5 p.m. Central Time and at 6 p.m. Eastern Time right here on blogtalkradio.com and on drmarakarpel.com. And today is Sunday, January the 14th, 2024, and I'm psychologist Dr. Mara Karpel and we are back live with another great program for you. And Art Mendoza of Accomplice Entertainment, producer of this show, is here, of course, to make it run smoothly as usual. And in a little while after the break, we'll be joined once again by Vietnam War veteran, Zen Buddhist monk, founder of the Zalto Foundation, and author Claude Anshin Thomas, who has been on the show several times. And this time, Claude is here to help us get 2024 off to a good start with a discussion of finding our inner peace in a time of chaos. And then later in the program, I'll be speaking just a little bit about regaining passion and purpose after loss. And after the program, you can hear this evening's show again by going to my website, and the link to the podcast will be posted later tonight, along with any website links that we discuss on the program. And you can hear the podcast in as soon as 5 minutes after the show ends by going directly to blogtalkradio.com/yourgoldenyears. And you'll also be able to hear it on Apple Podcasts. And for information from previous programs and to listen to all of the previous programs since we've been on Blog Talk Radio, which is now about 11 years, you can go to my website, drmarakarpel.com, and you can also hear all of those programs on Blog Talk Radio, B-L-O-G, talkradio.com/yourgoldenyears. And all of those programs are also on Apple Podcasts. And for upcoming programs and events, be sure to follow me on Facebook, Dr. Mara Karpel, Your Golden Years. This show is produced by Accomplice Entertainment and Psyched Up Productions. And we're going to take a brief break, but it'll be very brief, so don't go anywhere. And when we come back, we will be joined by Zen Buddhist monk Claude Anshin Thomas. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Super Psychologist Dr. Mara Karpel will be back after words from our sponsors.
Are you or a loved one a Medicare beneficiary? Help save you and Medicare money by stopping Medicare fraud. Fraud happens when Medicare is billed services or supplies you never received. There are three easy things you can do to prevent fraud. Review your Medicare claims for accuracy, protect your personal information, and look for any suspicious activity. For more information or to report fraud, call Medicare at 1-800-MEDICARE or call your local Medicare SHIP program at 1-800-252-9240.
Please visit us on the web at www.drmarakarpel.com.
And we are back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Karpel and Your Golden Years right here on blogtalkradio.com and on drmarakarpel.com. And now joining us on the phone once again is Vietnam War vet, Zen Buddhist monk, founder of the Zalto Foundation, and author Claude Anshin Thomas. Welcome back, Claude.
Dr. Karpel, nice to be with you again.
Yeah, so nice to start off the year with a conversation with you. So thank you for coming back to the program.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It's
my
been
pleasure.
A while. It's been a while. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you and to all those who listen to your show.
Yeah. So maybe before we dive into the conversation, for those who haven't heard you on this program before, maybe you can give a little bit about your background.
I can, surely I'll start with, I joined the U.S. military at the age of 17. I volunteered to go to Vietnam shortly after my 18th birthday. I served one tour in Vietnam, which is 12 months. I was injured quite seriously, spent some time in the hospital. I was being treated for the injuries that I received. I was being treated with narcotics. They never stopped giving those to me. When I was discharged, I spent a number of years dependent on narcotics and other drugs, to include alcohol. I stopped using those in 1983, and I have remained abstinent since. I was ordained, fully ordained as a Zen Buddhist monk in the Japanese Soto Zen tradition 25 years ago. I started a foundation. I established a foundation, the Zalto Foundation, Z-A-L-T-H-O Foundation, Inc. It can be found online and at zalto.org. My initial motivation to start this foundation was to establish a tax-free base for people to donate money to and get some benefit from that to support Vietnam veterans to go back to Vietnam, because I discovered that returning to Vietnam was very healing for a lot of men. I would say men and women, but when I served, there weren't so many women serving active duty. Most of them were in the nursing corps. It's changed a great deal since then. The foundation has grown so much beyond that right now. It's still a very blue-collar foundation. We're not very wealthy, but the maximum that we can do with the support that we have. All the supports for the foundation come through donation. The board of directors are all volunteers. We support returning combat veterans who are having a difficult time establishing themselves in a world beyond, outside of combat. The reality of war never, ever leaves us. Never. And even though there are a lot of people selling or advocating different treatments or therapies that will help them transcend the realities of post-traumatic stress or moral injury, but in truth, those generally fall short. What I have found, especially in my own life, what I have found to be most supportive is learning how to live at peace with my unpeacefulness. And this is what led me, once I stopped using alcohol and other drugs, this is what led me to Buddhist practice. It was actually the suggestion of a social worker that I was in therapy with, who directed me to a meditation retreat that was being offered to Vietnam veterans at the time. This was like in 1990. And I begrudgingly went, and it was transformative for me. Not immediately. I had a lot of resistance, but something obviously resonated with me, and I just stayed with the practice. It was a practice that helped me to understand that first, meditation can't be taught, and meditation is not medication. It's not a cure. It's simply a tool that I can use to help me find peace with my unpeacefulness. It is also it's also important. It was important for me to get the instructions from the beginning and to really understand this, that meditation and daily life are not two things. So that it's the attention that I establish, the silence that I bring into my life, the attention to details, being willing to slow down. These are the things that have supported me. So to learn that everything I do is an act of meditation if I do it with intention and focus.
So I know that you work now helping veterans, but you also help non-veterans as well.
I absolutely do, yes. That's why I say the foundation has grown beyond that.
Right.
We do a lot of, the foundation does a lot of work with homeless communities. The foundation is also established in Europe and in South America. And so we work, the foundation is working in prisons. We're working with homeless populations. We also are being invited into locked psychiatric facilities. We've recently started an initiative called Veterans Animal Sanctuary, where predominantly we support veterans who have support animals or pets. And generally, this piece of the culture has a difficult time working in a regular way, and so they're lower on the economic scale. So when they have a pet that is supportive to them, and they run into difficulties with that, like the pet becomes ill, and then they don't have enough money really to cover the expense of whatever treatment is required. They reach out to us through their veterinarians, and this Veterans Animal Sanctuary supports them. That's set up primarily for veterans and their family members. I'm just trying to think. There's just so much that we do.
I know that you were, we spoke at one point you were in Eastern Europe helping refugees from Ukraine.
Yes, that's still happening.
That's still going on.
It is.
Okay. Go on.
Sorry, I forget about this delay thing.
Yeah.
We have a pretty extensive network established in Europe where we have contacts within the Ukrainian refugee community. And so members of the Zolfo Foundation in Europe are providing supports for refugees coming from the Ukraine into their various countries. So they'll first host them and then help them to navigate the bureaucracy of getting established with healthcare, getting established with a job, with job training, get them established with language training. They just help them to navigate that. There's an organization that has started in one of the European countries where a group of Russian expatriates and Russian refugees, along with Ukrainian refugees and expatriates, meet once a month or once every 2 weeks or once a month to find a way beyond the propaganda that's sold that brings these two cultures into conflict.
That's wonderful. That's really powerful. So I guess you know, one of the issues I think that a lot of people are dealing with right now is that, you know, so much is going on in the world and in our country, and even more so since the last time we spoke, where people are fighting right here because they disagree with each other on issues related to the world and related to this country, and there's an increasing feeling of disconnection with people who we even, you know, once thought were our friends. And, you know, after COVID, people were coming out of isolation, but it feels like things are much more isolating recently, and there's so much anger and anxiety and fear and violence. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for listeners in how we deal with that, how we deal with that feeling of disconnection from people we were once connected to, and that feeling of fear and worry, anxiety, anger, all right here in our home.
This question has come up a number of times, and every Sunday at 11 a.m. Central Standard Time, I do an open session online for questions and responses. People attend from all over the world, and they can ask any question they want, and I make my best effort to respond to it from a place of my own life experience and from my training study as a Zen Buddhist monk. And I often say that I'm not in the business of giving advice. So what I make an effort to do is to I have connections with a variety of different people from very different backgrounds to me. What I make an effort to do when I connect with these people is to just I make an effort to connect from a human place, not from an ideological place. So I'm not interested in arguing with them or debating with them about their particular political, religious position or their particular ideological position based on what's going on in the world, but rather bring the focus. This is what helped me in my training as to become a Zen monk, was to bring the attention back to me. There's very little I can do on a global scale to change the trajectory of what's happening. What I can do is not be an instrument of that, to not propagate that. Coming out of COVID, what I cautioned people regularly was, do not, as we begin to come in contact with one another, don't expect it to be like it was before. Meet the contact in a new way. And it's, so how do we live in the world today based on the realities of the last couple of years? How have they affected us? How have we lived through them? Meditation practice and keeping in mind that meditation and daily life are not two things. It's about living life intentionally. Has me looking at, where do we connect? Not where are we different? I had an incident with a person who lives in the area, lives across the street from where I currently am hosted. And there was someone, a craftsperson here doing some work, and they had parked in a way that made it a little bit challenging for them to get in and out of their driveway. It didn't block the driveway. The person, and I'd known this person for some time, they came walking over to the house. I could see them coming. So I went to the front door and motioned for them to come to the side door like I normally do, and they started to just scream at me about this car parking. The best thing I could do in that moment, not react in the ways in which I am trained and conditioned to react, to not replicate the violence, and it was the nature of the language and the way it was being delivered was aggressive. It was violent. To just not to not react to that. What I ended up, not saying too much to the person other than, look, please, if this is an issue for you, please call the police. And don't come here and screaming at me like this. And to not raise my voice, to not respond in kind. Because there is no solution. There is no solution in violence, none. Even if it appears to work, it doesn't really work. Violence only gets more violent, sooner or later, someplace or other.
Right. Right. So calmly responding to people.
I don't know if I was, I don't know how calm I was.
Okay.
But I wasn't screaming and yelling. Yeah. I made an effort to be as steady as I could be.
Right. Okay. Okay. Any thoughts about how to, I guess, deal with that feeling of isolation? That is, you know, we're out of a pandemic, but we're feeling more isolated, or just as isolated, perhaps. Because of so many differences, you know, like political differences divided people. You found your group of people that you felt like, okay, these are my people. And then other things happen in the world and differences of opinion about those particular things divided that group of people who you thought were your friends. And now you're feeling like, okay, so who are my people? And it's a very lonely feeling.
Yeah, I do understand that. I will say that even amongst that group of people, I look to see where am I connected, not where I am different. Because there's still some place that I can connect. So if I attach my connection to people based on what I believe to be like-mindedness, I will at some point always be let down. I'll always be disappointed. I have to the people who are close to me. I have a large group of people that I'm connected with, that I'm engaged with. But the people who are genuinely close to me, they're very small, maybe a handful. And our connection isn't a connection out of sameness. We may actually, on some instances, we actually have some very different positions politically and ideologically, but we connect at a very human level. And that makes all the difference in the world. I don't argue with them or debate with them. They have a right to believe how they believe. It doesn't change the underlying connection that I have with them. And it also doesn't change the fact that there's nothing that I wouldn't do for these people if they needed help or support. So where do I connect, not where am I different? Yes, I look at when people talk about the tenderness or the fragility of how they experience the world today, and I simply go, yeah, but you didn't grow up when I grew up.
Right.
A lot of people forget what it was like in this country post-Second War. They forget what was like, what the political climate was like then. And they forget what it was like with the fighting in Korea. They forget. They quickly forget what the 60s were like in this country. They quickly forget the fragility of the social political climate at that time. I remember when I was discharged from the military hospital, and I returned back to Pennsylvania, where I was living at the time, in Western Pennsylvania. I went to the local veterans organization as a club. Now, when I got out of the military, I grew my hair quite long, and yeah, it was down below my shoulders. I walked into this club, and I remember I was on the pool table, and a man came up and said, "Well, we only allow veterans in here." And I said, "Well, I am a disabled combat veteran from Vietnam." And then he looked at me and said, "Well, we don't let losers in here."
Oh,
and
wow.
My response at that time, I didn't have the impulse control that I have now. My relation to the world was much different than it is now. And that response didn't turn out well for him or for me. And,
mm-hmm.
and so the climate, I remember in sort of central Pennsylvania, I was out on my motorcycle and I had a female partner that I was riding. She was riding behind me. We stopped in a town in the mountain town in Pennsylvania, went into a diner, and I had long hair and I was motorcycle riding, had a helmet and things, and it was this hippie times, and they wouldn't, this restaurant wouldn't serve us.
Mm-hmm.
They refused the
mm-hmm.
service. I've just learned how small-minded that is. We've lived through some difficult times and quite fragile times. I can't dwell on the things that I don't have any control over. I can attend to the things that I do have some direct impact with. Mostly what I can care for is I can learn from those experiences how I don't want to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you made a really good point with that, and you said before that we don't, whatever our opinion is, I think with social media, people feel like they have more power than they really do. We don't have the power over changing what happens in the world just by yelling it out on social media, right? But it often feels that way.
There's a certain anonymity that comes with social media that gives people the opportunity to act irrationally, to
mm-hmm.
show their bottom side.
Right.
I have absolutely zero presence on social media. I don't even go there because it's such an unreal world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that there haven't been some movements on social media that have led to some significant change.
Mm-hmm.
But this notion, notion of invisibility, where I can just say whatever I want or do whatever I want. When I was growing up, say in the late 50s, early 60s, I can remember going to the near, I grew up in a very small rural community, like 900 people in northwest Pennsylvania. I would travel to the next biggest city. And there, I remember I would do all kinds of crazy things because I felt anonymous. And nobody
mm-hmm.
knew me. Like in the community where I grew up, my father was a school teacher there. It's like he knew things that I was doing before I got home.
Right.
Like everybody knew everybody. And in the larger city, that wasn't the case. And so with
mm-hmm.
that sort of sense of invisibility, I just acted out all kinds of silly things. I think social
right.
media invites that.
It does. But I think even with, you know, with your friends who, you know, people who you have conversations with who we might know off of social media, there's a feeling that if I can convince my friend of this point of view, it'll change the world. But it doesn't. It has no bearing on what happens in the world.
What I have found is that if I don't attempt to convince my friend of the wrongness of their position and the rightness of my position, if I don't attempt to convince them of that, if I make an effort to meet them right where they are, I have a lot more, our relationship is a lot stronger and I have a lot more possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of them listening to me.
Right. Right. That makes sense. So, I mean, that brings me to the next part of this. So, you know, I talked about the feeling of disconnection and we talked about how we relate to other people. Now, how do we bring that feeling of peace inside of ourselves when we see all this fighting going on around us in the world and also in our own neighborhood and with and around our own friends? How do we maintain that feeling of stability within us?
There isn't a formula for that.
Okay.
I have to really want to live differently. I have to understand that my problems are not external and my solutions are not external. If I want my life to be different, I need to live differently. So I need to be willing to cultivate that. I need to be willing to understand what is my suffering? What are my tendencies here, and how does that feed into the unstableness that I seem to experience in the world? And what do I need to stop doing so I don't sort of jack that up on steroids or something?
Mm-hmm.
I really need to be willing to live differently. I really need to not play into the extreme social narratives or the extreme political narratives. And when I say extreme, I don't have anything in particular in mind. I'm just saying that peace is not
mm-hmm.
no political solution that will arrive to peace. It doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Peace is not a political mm-hmm. process. It's a very personal process. And I have to give up my ideas of what peace is and be willing to look at what is my unpeacefulness, and how can I learn to establish a new relation with that? It's a difficult path to navigate on my own. With that,
mm-hmm.
I need some support. So in my circumstances, what I needed was a community of people committed to this path, to a path of waking up to this stuff of self that creates more suffering. And then I needed that community to be supported by, in my case, an authentic teacher. In the beginning,
mm-hmm.
for me, in the beginning of this journey, the authentic teachers for me, the first was an MD psychiatrist who was willing to work with me and not medicate me, but work with me. And then that evolved into this very supportive, tender, and caring relation I had with this social worker, who was the one who directed me to the first meditation retreat. Even though I thought that this social worker was out of their mind, and I thought what she was sending me to was something all about religion, trusted in that person enough to take the step and go. And
mm-hmm.
that's been life-altering for me, absolutely life-altering.
So then finding communities and teachers that can support us is really important.
Yeah, teachers, guides. For example, in my case, everything I do for free. And people that I don't charge for what I do. If people value or support a value or benefit from their experience with what I pass on to them, and it's more the tools that I give them. It's more the disciplines and the rituals that I pass on to them. The thing that drew me to Zen practice was that person who I'm ordained by simply said to me, he said, "I don't care what you think. I don't care what you believe, and I don't care what you say. What's most important to me is what you do, so that my words
mm-hmm.
and my actions matched as much as they could, as often as they could." And that really invited me, especially they didn't care what I thought or believed in. It didn't matter, because I wasn't being asked to believe in anything in particular. I was being asked to do a certain set of things and do them in a certain way. And nothing was in violation of ethical and moral principles. And those simple tools that were passed on to me have helped
mm-hmm.
me to literally save my life.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty powerful.
It is. Yeah, it's very powerful. And the 13th of April, 1983, I ended up in intensive care from a conscious decision to overdose. There was a suicide attempt. So when I hear about the number of veteran suicides, or if I hear about suicide, I am not surprised by that. I understand it very intimately. And what I know is that there's not a medical solution to that issue. And so when I say that those two individuals helped me to save my life, it wasn't that the psychiatrist did some Ouija stuff with me and I was all better. This psychiatrist helped me. He gave me information I needed to absorb, and I needed to try it out. I needed to do the work. And I was I must have been willing or I wouldn't be sitting here today. I was willing.
Right.
I wanted to live differently, and I didn't have any idea what that meant.
Right. I think that's a big part of it, is that you have to want to make change.
Yes.
But you also have to be given the tools, because if you had the tools, you would have been using them all along. So
yes.
having a good teacher. I'm sorry, you were going to say something.
Oh, I forget. I tell you this. Delay thing. I haven't really settled with it just yet, because the conversations with you, Dr. Coppell, are so spirited for me. I so value this opportunity. My mind starts to go quickly, and I don't have a 2-minute delay there. Or it's 2-second delay. Sorry. Given that. Like, I pass on the tools to people. However, they have to then engage with them. They have to work them. I can't work them for them. And so I get to see how much people really want to live differently by how they relate to the various tools. And they're very simple. Tools are very simple. It's sit just to sit, walk just to walk, eat just to eat. But there are structures around that, and then to carry that into your daily life, not rigidly, but in an organic way, to see how they can be carried into your daily life.
So that would be mindfulness, right? Is that what you would consider mindful living?
What I will say is that. Again, like meditation can't be taught, neither can mindfulness. Mindfulness, in the strict sense of mindfulness, is a byproduct of a disciplined spiritual practice rooted in self-reflection. Mindfulness really can't be taught. And this word has been sort of co-opted and converted into a moneymaker. And that's happened throughout history within the realm of Buddhist practice. You can say that the practices can lead to self-awareness, that self-awareness can be, can show itself as mindfulness. But any idea we have of mindfulness separate from these disciplined practices is not truly mindfulness. That makes me a little bit controversial in the larger order of things, because there's such a big mindfulness movement, and there's so many now licensed mindfulness teachers. I hold steady with this reality that to attempt to teach mindfulness without extrapolated from the larger context with which it grows from is like removing your little finger and asking it to function independently from your hand.
So you're a purist when it comes to this.
Well, I don't know. I won't argue with that.
Okay.
I wouldn't use the word. But what I would say is that I think it's important to understand things within the larger context from which they came.
So that makes sense.
If a person gets introduced to mindfulness, then take it upon themselves to do some research and understand really what it is, understand a bit more about this thing called mindfulness, the history of it, where it comes from, the context with which it's grown out of. I don't mind being called a purist because I've been called a non-purist in other circles.
Okay. So how can listeners find out about the Zaltel Foundation and find out about your books and your meditations? I know you have some meditations online. Is that correct?
This is correct, yes. If they will go here and they go online, they can find the foundation's easy to find. It's at www.zalto, that's Z as in zebra, ALTHO.org. They will go onto that website and they will find that we have online offerings every Thursday and Saturday where we do a period of formal sitting followed by recitations. We sit online at 6 p.m. Central Time and on Thursday, 8 a.m. Central Time on Saturday. We ask people that join us to be on camera. I don't accept people who come to sitting practice to not be on camera. I don't accept that. I want them to be on camera and be on camera 5 minutes before the time of sitting starting. And then there's an open session of questions and responses at the same address. It's all on Zoom. And then as soon as I hang up, as soon as we finish our conversation, I go right out to the meditation hall because I have an online veterans group that's rooted in the discipline. It's a discipline meditation practice. So they can find us at zalto.org, and all of the information is there. The work that we do is all listed there. If people want to know about our finances, that's all listed there. And we make an effort to be as transparent as possible. The online offerings are listed there, and ways to get in contact with us are listed there. Also, people are very welcome to write to me. I have my email address is Anshin, A-N-S-H-I-N, at zalto.org. If they write to me, and I only encourage them, the shorter the email, the quicker the response. I make an effort to respond to all communicate, all.
Wonderful. I'm going to make sure to post that on my website post about this show later tonight. Thank you so much. I know you have to get going because I know you have that group right now. And we're running around. I kept you a little longer.
That's quite okay. I still have 16 minutes.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
You don't have to go far.
No, it's a 2 or 3 minute walk.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much. I always enjoy speaking with you, and I'd love to have you back on again. In the near future and continue this talk. I always feel calmer after I speak to you. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. I can say from my side, I equally value these opportunities. My conversations with you are very, they're very alive. They're very alive. And I really value that. So thank you so very much, and I hope we can continue to be like this.
Yes, and I'm glad to hear that. I really am. And you have a wonderful evening, and we'll be speaking again soon.
I look forward to that. And stay warm.
Yes, you too.
And please stay safe.
Yeah, same to you. Thank you.
So, yeah, to you and your listening audience, I place my hands together, palms pressing, and I bow to them in gratitude.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Hey, have a good evening.
Yes, thank you
bye-bye.
So much. Bye-bye. Yeah, bye-bye.
All right. We're going to take a very quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Dr. Mara's book, The Passionate Life, Creating Vitality and Joy at Any Age, is now available on Kindle and in paperback at Amazon. Don't forget to listen to Dr. Mara Karpel and Your Golden Years live from Austin, Texas, every Sunday on blogtalkradio.com.
Please visit us on the web at www.drmarakarpel.com.
And we're back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Karpel and Your Golden Years right here on blogtalkradio.com and on drmarakarpel.com. How do I follow that? That was really just so wonderful. It's always a pleasure to speak with Claude and to get his perspective. It's so calming. And I think we really need that right now. And so in the few minutes that we have left, I'm going to keep this pretty brief, and I will continue talking about this topic in the next few shows. I just want to talk about the whole idea of finding our purpose and our passion after loss. For those of you who have been listening to this program or who have followed me on social media or read my blogs, then you know that my mom was someone who I was an advocate for in terms of her health care and her care in a nursing home for the last few years. And it became more of a main part of my life in the last two and a half years when, you know, as she got older and older and needed more care and moved into a nursing home after having been in the hospital for a month, where I became very involved. And I've spoken quite a bit on the program about the things that I was doing for her and what I was learning on the job, because having worked with older adults for the good part of the 30 years that I've been a psychologist, or over 30 years, with a specialty in geriatrics in graduate school and working primarily with geriatrics the first several years, working in nursing homes and other long-term care communities, I still was not prepared for dealing with the issues of actually being a family advocate for a loved one in a nursing home when my mom moved in. And I really learned a lot more when she became a nursing home resident and when she was in assisted living and in the hospital. So I've written several blogs about the things that I've learned. I've spoken about it here. In particular, I started a family council in her community and facilitated that family council for a few months. We as a group accomplished many things. And this whole job of advocating and caregiving for a loved one, even if you're not a 24-hour caregiver who lives with you, but they live in a community, is a really big job. And I don't think that people can truly understand it until they've been in that situation. And many family caregivers don't know what to do. And I did have a little bit of a leg up on that because of my background working as a psychologist in nursing homes, but I was willing to push it and learn more on right there on the job. And so I set out to take care of my mom, help to keep her to have the best quality of life, and to help other family members dealing with the same thing through my writing and doing this program. And then my mom passed away unexpectedly at the end of October. And it was pretty sudden, so that all of that went away. Like that job that I had, that was almost like another full-time job on top of my day job, went away. My purpose for the last couple of years was taking care of my mom. So when other things came up in my life, when things were difficult or the world got difficult, I was able to put it into perspective by thinking about how, you know, those things are really not as important as taking care of my mom. And then that went away too, that sense of purpose, that feeling of perspective of other things not being quite as important, that balance that that taking care of her gave me. Of course, along with the relationship with my mom, we were very close and we got closer, and she really, I would say, was like my bestie for the last couple of years, you know, meeting with her on Zoom every day. So there's that part of it. But then there is that purpose and passion part that stopped. I stopped running the family council because I was no longer a family member, and I stopped making the phone calls to make sure she was all right, all of those things. And what I discovered in looking for resources for myself to find a way to reignite that passion now that she was gone and that purpose, that there really are not many resources, if any. If they're out there, I couldn't find them. There are bereavement groups. There are tons of bereavement groups and groups were online, and a lot of people seem to be making a lot of money at it too, advertising their groups. And if you pay this much, you can be in the group to talk about your grief or, you know, write about it or whatever. There are Facebook communities about grief. There are also Facebook communities for caregivers. But there are no communities for caregivers who have lost the person that they cared for. And that's a very complex sort of grief, because you've not just lost the person, but you've lost a purpose. And so what I've been working at is creating that for myself. And in doing that, I'm trying to create something that other people can find useful, because every caregiver, every advocate for a loved one who is elderly in the healthcare system is going to be in the position that I'm in. Everybody's going to lose that person. And it isn't going to just be about grief. It will, if they've been very involved, it will hit them that suddenly all of those, the things that they have found to bring purpose into their life in relation to caregiving, they just suddenly evaporate. And so I decided that this would be the passion and the purpose that would honor my mom the best. And I think she would really be glad that I did this. And so I'm working on that. I also in looking back at when my dad died and 8.5 years ago, I realized that, and I don't think I saw it at the time, that what really got me through that, you know, the darkness of the grief pretty quickly was that I had my mom to take care of, that I had to direct my attention toward making sure that she was okay, because after he passed, she had some issues with her health right around that same time. But now that she's gone, you know, that's not there. So I'm directing my, that energy that I put into my mom, I'm directing it toward helping family members to advocate for their loved ones, helping to bring more awareness to ageism in the healthcare system. In fact, you know, I'm working on some projects right now. I'll talk about them at a later time, in helping family members to really know what's going on, because knowing the system is really important in caring for your loved one. And then somehow journaling or documenting this journey of finding passion and purpose after that, that purpose goes away. And so that's what I want to let you know about, and I will be keeping you posted on this journey down this new path that I'm on in creating some new resources that don't seem to exist. So on that note, we're going to end here. And I first, let me let you know what's happening in the next couple of weeks. Next Sunday, January 21st, we'll be playing an encore of one of our recent favorites. And then on the Sunday after, on January 28th, we'll be back with another live program, and we'll be joined by Jake Sloan. Jake Sloan spent most of his adult life working as a civil rights advocate and labor management consultant, and he'll be discussing his new book, Standing Tall, Willie Long versus the U.S. Government at Mare Island Naval Shipyard. And this book is about Jake's experience as one of the original 21ers, a group of young African-American workers who challenged the largest West Coast U.S. naval base to provide equal opportunities and wages, and they won, influencing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So that's a pretty exciting discussion, and that'll be in 2 weeks. And if you want to hear tonight's program again and listen to this wonderful interview with Claude Anshin Thomas, or read the information from this program and get the links that we talked about, you can go to my website, drmaricarpel.com. You can also hear all of the previous programs in the last 11 years by going to my website. And you can also listen to this evening's program in as soon as 5 minutes from now by going directly to blog, B-L-O-G, talkradio.com/yourgoldenyears. And you can listen on Apple Podcasts in 5 minutes. Be sure to follow me on Facebook, Dr. Mara Carpel, Your Golden Years. This show was produced by Accomplice Entertainment and Psyched Up Productions. And thank you to my guest, Claude Anshin Thomas. And thank you to Art. Thank you all for listening. Have a peaceful night, an inspiring couple of weeks. And remember, youth has no age. Good night, everyone. Stay safe.
C'est le bon ton roulé. That is what they all say. C'est le bon ton roulé. That is what they all say. C'est le bon ton roulé. That is what they all say. C'est le bon ton roulé. That is what they all say. Et toi.
Any guidance offered by Dr. Carpel is not intended to replace the advice of your own physician or mental health specialist. Neither Dr. Karpel, her sponsors, nor this station assumes responsibility for the misuse of any information on this program.